no clue of what genetic material was. Watson and Crick told us the DNA and showed us how the molecule double helix works, and ever since then people have been tinkering around it. Nowadays, we can chop up a gene and analyze its base pairs one after the other on an automated system. They've been able to, you know, it took months and months to do it for a human subject. Nowadays, I think it's down to a couple of weeks, and the price is plummeting. And you can do it to a virus because it has much less genetic material, much faster. So there's a lot of labs that have been genotyping specimens of the virus from different areas, and they can tell the difference between a Wuhan virus and an Italian virus and an American virus, and you'll notice as time goes on that they'll give you a very interesting lesson in how these viruses went from A to B to C to D. And the thumbprint that they're using is the genetic drift and the genetic code that they've been decoding all this time. And they'll continue to do that, no doubt.
Okay, very good. You know, Governor Cuomo says that, you know, there was the Chinese virus that came in from China, but this one came in from Europe. He called it the European virus. Is he saying it was something different, or is it just one that had gone, you know, the same thing, just went to different places before it got here?
Yeah, in the case of the United States, it took a circuitous route. It went from Wuhan, China, to Italy, and Italy to most of Europe, and then European traffic to New York especially got it here, and the high population density spread it around real good. And of course, New York is a hub for the nation, if not an international hub, and so it's spread out across the country. It looks like a lot of the national virus originated, at least in this country, around New York. There were separate areas where it popped up in Washington and California, but the New York strain, pretty much everyone agrees, came from Wuhan to Italy and then from Europe to the United States.
Okay, thanks for that.
Okay, any further questions on this subject before I wrap it up and turn it over to Paul? If you got any questions, please feel free.
WB2KWC.
Yes, Cap.
Okay, I have some friends that kind of make fun of me for wearing a mask. Their argument is that the virus is so much smaller than, small enough to get through an N95 mask. So their theory is that masks are useless. And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking we do not sneeze out pure viruses, but they ride on something, droplets of moisture or whatever. And I've never had anyone to ask about it. So, I'm nominating you to ask about it.
Okay, Ken, I am more than happy to attempt my best to answer that. N95 masks are designed pretty much on the basis that they will block 95% of particles that are anywhere from about 100 microns to 250 microns and larger. The coronavirus is approximately 120 nanometers. They're 125 nanometers in diameter for the most part. So they'll block 95%. They won't block all 100%. So you're improving your risk of not becoming infected, but it's not perfect. And there are some better designed, much more expensive, much more pain in the backside masks that limit your risk even more. But most hospital staff tend to use N95s. as opposed to the so-called surgical or fabric masks, which really don't trap any small particles. The purpose of the face covering is not so much to protect you from becoming infected from fomites, from these little particles of suspended water, but to lessen the risk of you infecting other people by the spittle when we talk, when we yell, when we sing, when we cough, when we sneeze. All that gets sprayed into the air, and theoretically, if you got it on a fabric mask, you might get some degree of help, but not a lot. The virus itself could kind of, if it soaked the fabric enough, go right through it. So it's a one-sided safety measure. It's primarily to protect others from yourself. And so if everyone wears them, everyone's protected from everyone else. And so it has a benefit in that way. And so I hope that answers the question. If not, please ask away.
I think you've answered it. I actually, as far as the folded bandanas and the cloth masks and the paper masks, are they of any use, or are we just making ourselves more comfortable?
Well, it depends. If you ask, is it effective to a degree in limiting the person's ability to infect other people? Yes, it does, because the human, the mouth, when it coughs and sneezes and talks and sings and yells, it produces a spray of little fine bubbles of water. If they're very, very small, they can be smaller than the size of the virus, so they're not going to include virus particles. So they have to be somewhat larger fomites, larger balls of water, to carry more than one coronavirus, and so that introduces a bigger size. So if you're coughing out fomites and you have a piece of cloth covering your mouth, most of those fomites are going to be trapped in that mesh of either paper or material. So there'll be less of those fomites that will waft in the air and reach the mucous membranes of another human being and have an infection from that.
Okay. Thank you, Roy, and thank you for teaching me a new word, fomite.
Okay, very good. I mean, if there's one thing this unfortunate virus has done, is teach a lot of people new words and many concepts of epidemiology, and in some cases how to spell epidemiology. So it's been a learning experience. I would rather read a book about it than live it, but the universe doesn't work that way. So I thank you very much, Ken, for your question. I think it's already 10:23, so let me just tell you a couple little links and addresses, and then we'll move on to Paul's space report. If you have any mailbag questions for the technical net, and you're not able to get on the radio, but you would like it answered, or if you have any topics that you would like to hear discussed, if you have any physics questions or science questions or science topics, or have any puzzlers that you'd like to share with me so I can use them, so I don't have to go running around and dig them up myself, or if you want me to kind of tell Paul about a website or a video or something that you would like his opinion about, space-related, NASA-related, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And usually I have a link page that I use, roy.ac2gs.com. That's available, but because I didn't really do any stories, I'm not quite sure if I'm going to put up any links for tonight's episode. If I can think of something that's appropriate, I will. And once again, I want to remind people that Mike, KC2NJI, has his website, amateurradio.tv, where he has archives of the technical net from 2006 on. And also want to thank everyone who participated this Friday night and Saturday morning in Dick K2RIW's Radio Wake. I thought it was a very interesting experience, and I'm glad that I was a part of it. I'm glad that everyone who participated was a part of it. If anyone wants a link to an archive audio of this, they can email me, or I'm sure in a short period of time, Mike, KC2NJI, will post it on his website, amateurradio.tv. So I want to thank everyone for participating tonight, and you made the TechNet what it is, and you always do. So with no delay, for the Space Report, I bring you Paul, WS2N. Here you go, Paul.
Roy, can I get a question for the TechNet?
Okay.
ISW2HL, my friend here wants to ask you a question relating to something at a third party.
Yeah, this is Barry. You were talking about the virus coming from Wuhan. But and then you were talking about Coleman said you know, there was a different strain coming in from Italy. Did you know that there's a big Chinese community in Italy? And this is what I heard from someone who knows Italy, and they were coming straight into Wuhan. Into Italy. That's how the virus spread throughout Europe, also the United States. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, my general understanding is that it's more of happenstance that there was a lot of trips back and forth between China, especially the Wuhan province, especially in the early days when everyone was confused, and European countries, and among them Italy. I am not quite aware that anyone has decidedly blamed a Chinese-Italian community for this particular thing, but, you know, I don't know. It's easy to genotype a viral strain. It's a little bit more difficult to find agent zero of any particular variation of the viral strain. So that probably will not be provable in the near future.
What happened was there were a lot of people... I mean, look, the Chinese government closed down the domestic flights in China, and they opened up the international flights to the rest of the world, especially the Western world. Doesn't that show you something there?
Well, I don't know whether this is a conspiracy, which what it sounds like you might think, and maybe it is, but I don't think so. I think it's more incompetence and greed and other things, that they wanted their economy not to suffer, and so shut things down locally because they sort of knew how terrible it was, but they didn't want to go whole hog by screwing around with the rest of their economy. And they should be taken to task for that, and they should be made to pay for that. But this is politics, and it depends upon what people and what countries have. And China has a relatively big stick, and although thankfully they're not really a militaristic country, they like a paper tiger, they have a lot of people in uniform, and they beat up their own citizens, but thankfully, so far, they haven't beat up other citizens. They use much more coercive methods to cajole people into doing what they want. So, again, I don't think the Chinese are blameless, but unfortunately, there are countries that got on the stick rather quickly, South Korea being one, Taiwan being another, and they have a much lower death rate than places like Italy and Spain and such, and especially now Brazil.
Question K2QR.
Yes, Fred.
Could you just comment on the possibility of this virus being aerosolized?
Okay, aerosolized means a specific thing. It means that small water droplets can be sustained in the air currents over a prolonged period of time. As far as I'm aware, most indications are that people have been infected person to person. Even though the fomites can drop onto materials and be viable for days, they have not really demonstrated that the infections come mostly from that. So it's person to person. Usually they give the rough estimate of 6 feet of distance. That's also 2 meters, which is probably where they came up with the 6 feet worth of it. So it lessens your chance but doesn't zero it. I do not think, though, that the coronavirus can be aerosolized over a long period of time. And there have been no research studies that would indicate that. The size of the droplet required for a collection of coronaviruses just tends to be too heavy. In artificial environments where you can blow air up and keep atomized water droplets from the surface for prolonged periods of time, for experiments, you can do that. But in the real world, it doesn't happen. So I don't think at this point it can be aerosolized.
Okay, because I was wondering if it could be aerosolized, like if you were in, well, let's go back to an office. They're going to put people into offices. The offices have air conditioning. Now you have the potential of a lot of people having the virus, but not knowing they have the virus, it's going to pass through the central air conditioning system. It's going to be aerosolized, possibly, you know, and that's where I was going with that. Back to that.
Yeah, I understand, Fred. There have been viruses in the past that were capable of that. I'm blocking on the virus Legionnaire's disease. Yes, Legionnaire's disease is a perfect example of that. It festers in still water, and the cooling and air conditioning system had still water in areas, and it picked up the virus and spread it across the hotel. So in those cases, that particular virus can be aerosolized. But again, as far as I know, and they've done lots and lots of tests, but they'll continue to do different tests, this is not the case for coronavirus. Whenever anyone puts up a epidemiological observation of who was infected by who, it's always a local infection. They had these diagrams at large religious gatherings early on in the virus where they'll show you where people were sitting, and it just spreads right out across in a circular radial pattern, which kind of demonstrates that it's not like there's a cloud that just covers the entire ceiling. So I understand what you're trying to say, and thankfully this is one problem that presently doesn't seem to be a problem with this coronavirus.
Okay, great. No, I understand. All right, thanks very much. Back to that.
Okay, very good. Thanks for all the questions. And if you need more time, you know, 11 o'clock is a very soft boundary, so you can go for as long as you would like. So please, Paul, take it away.
This is WS2N, and yeah, we have a big buffer zone now, so no problem. Okay, like I said in the beginning of that, you know, my main topic is going to be the flight to the International Space Station that took off yesterday at 3:22 from Launch Complex 39A from Florida, which, of course, is the first launch of American astronauts from American soil to orbit to the International Space Station. And thankfully it was successful, and they launched on a Falcon 9 rocket with a Dragon crew vehicle on top. The crew consisted of Doug Hurley and Bob Behnken. And the good thing about that is, for me anyway, is Bob Behnken is a ham radio operator, KE5GGX, and hopefully he'll get to make some contacts when he's on the International Space Station. 19 hours after launch, they docked with the station. They came up underneath it. Space Station has to shut things down. They shut those big solar panels from moving. Those solar panels are like the equivalent of 24-story buildings spinning on the port side and the starboard side. They spin every orbit, which is every 90 minutes. Let me drop it. They have to shut that down, and they also want any kind of movement with the space station. They shut any possible thrusters down. They stabilize the gyros on board the space station, and this way the crew vehicle could drift in very slowly, which it did. And actually, before they got there, Doug Hurley operated it manually. They want to know if all the controls and everything, they're able to control it and report back on how it feels. And they said it was exactly like the simulators. But then they shut that off, and it's a hands-off situation, and the computer brings it in, lines everything up, makes sure it's going in parallel. And it docks successfully to the ITA. The ITA is the International Docking Adapter. One half is on station, and the other part is on the crew vehicle. They wind up with a soft docking, and then over about a half hour, they have these big latches. There's 12 of them. They pull them, two of them together, and they get what's called a hard dock. You know, a solid seal. And they went through all of that, and they got the door open over time. It took a couple hours after they did hard dock to come on board the International Space Station. And they joined the crew of three. There's only three up there now. Two Russians and Chris Cassidy. He's a NASA, presently the commander of the International Space Station. And he's also a ham, KF5KDR, and he's already made contact with students down below. So, now, very successful. They'll start planning on the next flight. Next flight is due to go up the last day of August, and they plan on bringing up, instead of two, they're going to bring up four people. If you look at the seat arrangement, when they first got into the crew vehicle on the launch pad, you know, they took the two center seats. There were four seats there, so it has the capability of taking four people, which they'll do next time. They'll take Shannon Walker. She's been up there before. Also a ham, KD5DXB, Michael Hopkins, another ham, KF5LJG, along with Victor Glover, K1BKC, and Sashi Nochi, which is a Japanese astronaut. He's been up before as well, KD5TVP. You can see he got his call letters in Texas. You can see the 5 on his call letter. But he's been up before. So, very successful. Two people up there now. And in the future, they'll add to that. And as they add to it, other people come back down. For the last couple of years, I'd say about 4 or 5 years, it's been a steady crew of six on the space station. And you'll notice now I said there were three up there, and that's because it's gotten a little expensive to send our astronauts up on a Soyuz rocket from Kazakhstan by the Russians. They launch on a Soyuz rocket, and the price has been going up. And originally, I remember it cost like $19 million per seat when they started doing that. Actually, it was free because what we did with the Russians, you know, we would take them up in the shuttle, and we would also go up in their Soyuz rocket. But as time went on, they started charging $19 million a seat, and the number kept climbing to, you know, 40 and 50, and now they're up to $85 million per seat. So Chris Cassidy, the commander up there, is, you know, we paid the Russians $85 million to put them up there. And now we sent them up on our own rocket, two people. So instead of, you know, getting closer, you know, to $200 million, you know, we're sending them up there roughly for about $50 million a piece, paying SpaceX to do that. And, of course, that's American money. It stays in, more or less in this country. You know, he's paying American workers to build the Falcon 9 rocket and to build the crew demo. And 8 minutes after launch yesterday, they successfully landed the booster back out in the ocean on the autonomous ship floating off the Carolinas. And the ship is like as big as a football field, and it came down like it's done many, many times. They've recovered over 50 of these boosters over the years. And, you know, this booster is 155 feet high and 12 feet diameter. Four legs come out, lands vertically, comes back to Cape Canaveral in that fashion. And they take it off when they get there in the port and refurbish it, refuel it, and send it up again. They've done this successfully. They started years ago, and they would just, you know, use the booster twice. Then they went up to three times and four times, and now they're up to five times. They'll reuse it. So they'll reuse this booster as well. Now this is a first flight for this crew and for the Dragon vehicle. So what they did was, they used a brand new booster. It's called a Block 5. They've had different iterations of the booster over the years, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And as time went on, they not only got stronger and better, they've almost doubled the thrust. You know, you wind up with 2 million pounds of thrust on the new boosters. Everything went well. The astronauts reported that it was a little rougher ride on the shuttle, on this one compared to the shuttle. You know, when the shuttle first takes off, yes, it's a real rough ride, but when the boosters separate on the shuttle, you know, the port and the starboard boosters leave, then they're being flown by the shuttle itself and the external fuel tank. They said that's a much smoother ride, that part of it, where when you're flying up on Falcon 9, pretty rough ride. You know, you can feel it, but it really still feels rough on the second stage. You have that first booster leaves and goes down and lands in the ocean on the ship. That second stage also has one Merlin D engine. That's what they call Merlin D, Merlin Delta. The Falcon 9 has nine Merlin Ds that lands on a platform in the ocean, and then the second stage has the one Merlin D. Except it's more equipped to operate in a vacuum. And that continues on until they get up to speed, you know, 17,500 miles an hour, and then they separate from the Crew Dragon and you know, at beautiful pictures, you can see it separating. You can see the trunk is the back part of the spacecraft, and the spacecraft itself going off and slowly into the distance. And 19 hours later, roughly a little over 12 orbits later, they, you know, that was this morning at like 10:30 in the morning when they finally docked with the ISS. The new vehicle runs on solar panels that are attached to the body of the spacecraft, and of course batteries inside. So all the way up, they're running on solar power and essentially battery power to dock with the space station. But then they're going to stay for, you know, anywhere from a couple of weeks to a couple of months. They said they, you know, depending how things go, they might stay up there for quite a while. And my guess is everything's going well, so they probably will. So they, after docking, they have this one connection that's also automatically, which picks up the power from the monstrous solar cells that are on the space station. Those solar cells are so powerful. You know, if you had 40 houses on Earth, you could power 40 houses. So they take some of that power and connect it to the Dragon vehicle. This thing stays alive for the next couple of weeks and months, and future missions, they could be staying for half a year or more. I think up to 210 days is the number. And, you know, my guess, a couple of months, rather than a couple of weeks, Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley will get to the Dragon spacecraft, undock from the space station, and deorbit, and they'll come down through the atmosphere with a heat shield generating up to 3,000 degrees, and then eventually that the parachutes, there's four big parachutes that will come out. They'll land, not on land, they're going to land in the Atlantic Ocean, where SpaceX will have a ship waiting to pick them up right out of the ocean and bring them onto deck, and then fly them back with a helicopter. And that's the story. Any questions or comments with this really a historical flight, this WS to land?
N1YDY?
N1YDY. Yes, go ahead.
Why is it only able to stay for 210 days or so? What's the limiting factor?
The thrusters on board run out by hydrazine, and you know, the oxygen is nitrogen tetroxide. So it's very similar to the Soyuz vehicles. They have the same expiration date. So that's why, like when we sent Scott Kelly up there, he went up on one Soyuz vehicle, and then as time went by, you know, that vehicle went back to Earth with different people, and he stayed on, and eventually he got a ride in another Soyuz vehicle because he was up there past that time frame. Back here.
So it's essentially a corrosion issue. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a, you know, I always thought it was corrosion too, but I've read recently that it's not really the case. It's I think a settling issue, something to do with the way the molecules settle, you know, attached to the walls. There's some chemistry involved that I'm not sure about, but it's not going to corrode the tanks or anything like that. Maybe it'll affect the thrusters themselves. that, you know, there's some mechanical things that just go on and, you know, open and close the valves and things. It might have something to do with that. But, yeah, it's because of the hydrazine fuel that they have a problem. Russians were supposed to send they call it Nokia. Nokia was another massive module that they were supposed to send up. And they kept having delays and problems, and, you know, the time went by, and the years went by, and they kept changing the fuel in the system. They had fueled it up, and after a while, they had problems with the thrusters and valves, and they scrapped the whole thing. They took all that stuff out, repiped everything, and they planned on sending it up to the space station. And, the years went by. It's like 10, 11 years now. It's still sitting in a Russian clean room somewhere. They still plan on sending it up, but I think they had some financial problems. But again, the expiration date on that came and went many times. Any other comments or questions on this mission? WS to us. Okay, well, there's a couple of other things going on. I'll be talking about this flight for probably some time, going on and on. Interesting, both astronauts that went up, and everybody talks about their families. Both wives happen to be astronauts. One is retired, but they've been up before, both of them. And this was the third flight for both of these people that have gone up. And Doug Hurley, his last flight was the final flight of the shuttle system when Atlantis went up in August of 2011. That was the final flight. And he was on that. So when they left, they left a flag behind, attached, you know, American flag attached to the door that opens up to lead to the International Space Station from the same docking port that they had left. So they left the flag there, and the deal was whatever American crew comes up next, and you know, in this case it's SpaceX. It almost was Boeing with the Starliner, but the Starliner has some problems. Went up into space, and computers' timers were off, and it used up too much fuel, and it never got a chance to dock with the space station. You know, it was an uncrewed vehicle, and a proof of concept. And if that was okay, then the next flight would have been manned. But because it wasn't okay, they got delayed, and they probably will go up next spring or maybe the end of this year. But it turns out SpaceX was the next crew to go up. So the deal was whoever goes up there first, they'll get to take that flag. It's like a game of capture the flag. They're going to take that American flag back with them whenever they come back. And I thought it was going to wind up in the Smithsonian or something. But it turns out that flag will go on to another spacecraft in the future, and it'll be the first American spacecraft. It doesn't have to be commercial, but the first American spacecraft to leave orbit. In other words, go to the moon, or, you know, not necessarily land on the moon, but to go around the moon. But whichever one it is, that will be it. I mean, Elon Musk could win on that too. He's got to deal with this one guy from Japan for, like, I don't know how many hundreds of millions of dollars. He's going to fly this guy around the moon sometime in the future. But I think that's probably around 4 years, maybe 5 years down the road. And I'm sure NASA will have that flag on board when they fly Orion on their flight around the moon, probably scheduled for 2022, 2023 time frame. So, and the history on that flag, it starts out even earlier. It was on the very first space shuttle that had gone up, Columbia. So it's been around. and it's going to keep flying. I would have bet anything it would have wound up in the Smithsonian Museum, but I guess not. Any questions before I move on? This is WS2S. Okay, we have a competition, of course. It's like the old days. Any of us that are old enough remember the space race with the Russians. Now it's kind of with China. China is pushing the envelope here. They haven't caught up to us yet, but they're trying. They have a planned space station that they plan on launching the first core module this year, and then a couple of other core modules that would be attached to it. And I think it's around 10 or 12 flights they're going to have to complete their space station. It won't be permanently manned, though. They plan on only going up for about 6 months at a time with only a crew of three. But still, you know, it's something. But right now they have a flight planned for this summer to go to Mars, just like we do. We have the Perseverance rover that's supposed to be launched on July 17th on an Atlas V American rocket from Launch Complex 41 in Florida. And our vehicle will go to Mars and do a direct EDL, entry, descent, and landing. You know, it'll just get to Mars and go right through the atmosphere and eventually, you know, land on Mars and start driving around, just like we did with Curiosity. Same type of exciting EDL. You know, you come through the atmosphere with the heat shield, and then you come with the one big parachute. It's going to be about 70 feet in diameter, and that's going to slow it down, and then eventually that parachute separates, and you're going to have just the sky crane with the eight rockets on there, you know, on an angle, like about 40 degree angle, facing away from the center. This way it doesn't. The exhaust doesn't affect the payload down below, which will be the rover Perseverance. And then the wheels will pop open, and it will land on the surface. It'll have some pyrotechnics go off, cutting the cables, and data cables, and communication cables, and that sky crane will fly away, you know, a mile or two away from the landing site. Well, China, not to be outdone, they plan on sending a vehicle up also in July. Now, our vehicle will land in February, and if their vehicle goes up in July, their vehicle will land in February as well. It's not going to take that many months. It takes roughly a half a year or so to get to Mars when Mars and Earth are relatively close to one another. And they can only do that, you know, once every 26 months when that happens. So if any of these flights, our flight or China's flight, you know, are delayed, they'll be delayed for a couple of years. But if they go off on time, they'll be landing roughly at the same time. But China doesn't have a direct EDL, direct entry, direct descent and landing system. They have an orbiter. They're going to put this one vehicle. It's called the Jianwen 1. We'll go to orbit around Mars, and that will serve a couple of purposes. One main purpose will be to act as a relay station. The other, for the land, that it's going to go down through the atmosphere. So they plan on landing on Mars. It's a rover. It's solar powered, not like ours. Curiosity and Perseverance are going to go. Which powers it. It keeps enough power going and keeps charging batteries day and night. That's how come we could go all these years. Curiosity has been riding around since 2012, and here we are 8 years later, still going. And hopefully the same will happen with Perseverance, but, you know, curiosity weighed 2,000 pounds, and this thing's a little heavy, around 2,250 pounds. And but China is a much lighter vehicle. It weighs around almost 600 pounds. But they're doing pretty good. I mean, you know, when we sent up Spirit and Opportunity, those things are great, weighed around 450 pounds. So we'll see if they make it. It's going to be their first, actually a second try. They tried to send a vehicle to Mars many years ago. They launched on a Russian rocket, and unfortunately for them, the Russian rocket never made it out of Earth orbit. It wound up crashing into the ocean with their Mars vehicle on it. So that's the story on China. Any questions, comments? WS2N. If you look at any pictures for the docking of the crew vehicle that just docked there today, they're into, you know, the forward port. There's actually a forward part of the space station, and there's a back part of the space station. There's a right side and a left side and up and down. The front of the station is has this Harmony node, they call it. It's a big module. And in front of that Harmony node, they have this pressure mating adapter, PMA-2, which is attached to it. And it's this conical thing. It's got this offset. It's around 22-degree offset contraption. So when you go in, it looks like they're dropping down a little bit to go in and then into the spacecraft itself. And the then attached to that is what they call the IDA, the internet docking adapter. The old shuttle used to attach directly to the pressure mating adapter. They changed all of that, and they made up this better adapter that Boeing built, and it's going to be an international deal. So any vehicles in the future, Dream Chaser or anything that's going to dock with the space station, will use the same IDA, the international docking adapter. But if you look at the pictures on the computer, you see it on TV, where it's docked, there's another big module that's sticking straight down. Right, it's only temporary because it's another spacecraft that was sent up by Japan. And it's a large, it's a lot bigger than the Dragon 2 that went up. It's a large spacecraft. You can see it's got a lot of solar panels on it, attached to it. Not panels, but solar cells. And it's around 33 feet long, and it's around 14 feet in diameter. And that was just sent up and docked, about a week ago. Sent up from Japan, from Takashima launch complex. And it launched on an H-2B rocket. Sent the a lot of weight, massive batteries that are in here that they're going to install on the International Space Station. Each battery weighs like 400 pounds or something, and then there's six new lithium batteries, and they're going to take out 12 old ones. But you'll see that set up there. So that went up there last week. I thought I'd mention that. The final cargo vehicle from Japan, they sent up, it's a total of 9. So they've been doing this for quite a few years, around 8 years now. They've done this, and they're going to retire this, but they're working on a new one, and a new one, better and more improved cargo vehicle, and that should go up around 2 years from now. But it's so advanced that it's not only going to be for the International Space Station. They plan on being one of the supplies of cargo to the new space station that will be eventually going around the moon, called Gateway. So they'll be able to leave orbit and then send their HTV vehicle to orbit the moon to supply future landings on the moon. So, okay, I'm going to come to a grinding halt here. I have many other topics, but there's other weeks to do this. I'm going to turn it back to Roy. Unless somebody has a question on this, if not, we'll go back to Dr. Roy. This is WS2M.
Hey, Paul, Hank again.
Hi, Hank. Go ahead, N1. YDI, WS2M.
Yeah, getting back to the Crew Dragon, I was reading somewhere that originally the design concept was for the Draco engines that we see on the side, those dark panels that are used for crew escape, were actually originally intended to also be for propulsor landing, and that NASA wasn't terribly excited about that concept. Do you have any information on that?
Well, I know, anything I've read, you're 100% right. That was the original plan. Elon Musk's idea was to have the crew vehicle go into orbit, do whatever it had to do, whatever space station it was going to go to, and then deorbit, you know, again, with heat, without a heat shield, without a parachute, just come straight down with the Super Draco engines. They're called Super Draco engines. There's regular Draco engines. The Draco engines are the Draco thruster. You know, they have 18 of them all over the vehicle. You know, they have you know, a couple hundred pounds thrust, or you know, maybe 25 pounds thrust, or whatever it might be, you know, for maneuverability. But then they made the Super Draco engines, and yeah, they actually would have that capability. He wanted to come out of orbit and come down propulsively all the way down to Earth and land like that. He was going to have these four little feet come out of the bottom of the heat shield. But, yeah, you're right. NASA says, I don't know. I think we need a parachute. So he thought, Elon said he hated parachutes. And, but, he, you know, he worked around it. A lot of failures with parachutes. He tested, you know, I think the last failure they had, which was like 6 months ago, he tested like 20 times just in between that time. You know, they'll send up a cargo vehicle, you know, a 135. They'll drop a heavy weight out of it, you know, with parachutes on it. So eventually I understand it's perfected. NASA's happy with it. And that's how they do it. Now, those Super Draco engines that you see, those four locations around the side of the vehicle. I know you know the tank, but the anybody else doesn't. They're used for an abort system. If you had to abort on the pad, you know, for instance, or going uphill all the way to the space station. You know, if all of a sudden the main booster or even the second stage decide to blow up as you're going to this, you know, up to orbit, the Super Dracos would ignite and pull you away from that. So, you know, if those things decided to blow up for any reason, and that would be your way out, and then eventually on the way down, parachutes would open, and you know, you would be rescued. And they power, there's up to, let's see, I think they said, collectively, I think it's 120,000 pounds of force. So it's just in those engines, built inside that spaceship, you have twice the amount of power than what the Redstone rocket had to launch Shepard into, you know, into space. He didn't go into orbit, but you know, that thing launched on 70,000 pounds of thrust. You know, look how far we've come. Now those things will never be used, hopefully. They're the ones that he had trouble with. You might remember two marches ago, he sent a crew vehicle, which was uncrewed, all the way to the space station. It docked. They opened the doors, one of the astronauts, woman astronaut, she went inside, checked everything out, eventually they closed the doors, and it was, again, a real proof of concept demo mission. Demo 1, they called it. So Demo 1 came back and landed, and they were going to reuse it. And they wanted to test the Draco engines. So they put it on a stand in Florida. And all of a sudden, the whole thing just blew up. I mean, there was nothing left. You know, they call it a rapid, unscheduled... rapid, I forget the term they get around with, unscheduled disassembly, that's what it was, completely destroyed. So they figured out what happened, that there's these check valves are, you know, fluids only go in one direction, and they had these check valves made in titanium, made of titanium, and apparently, it was pressurized. This is all on the ground, you know, they were testing it. They pressurized the nitrogen tetroxide, and it got past the check valve, broke the check valve, and these two things mixed and blew the whole thing up. So they said, oh no, this is a nightmare. Not going to make it. And I thought so too. I figured they're going to have to redesign everything. And I thought Boeing was going to succeed and be the first one to, you know, capture the flag on the International Space Station with their Starliner vehicle. But Elon Musk came up with a system, his engineers did, I'm sure, and they did away with the check valves entirely. They said, since we're only going to use this once, it only has to fire once, and, you know, it would be in an emergency on an abort system. So they put in these burst discs, they call them burst discs, like two flanges with this bladder in between that will only blow at a certain pressure. And that's what they use to separate the nitrogen tetroxide and the fuel, the hydrazine fuel. And, you know, when they need to, you know, if there's an emergency, there's helium that would instantly force these two together, the disc would burst, and you know, you'd be off to the races, and you would be saved. So, very good, Hank, on that question. Back to you, WS1.
Speaking of those titanium check valves, it's my understanding that that was a lesson that was learned earlier in the Apollo, actually in the Gemini program, in the testing for that. And even though they used the Titan II rocket, they apparently, in the process of man rating it, had put in a check valve that was made out of titanium, and that turned out to be a non-starter. It didn't survive the testing program.
Good to know, Hank. I didn't know that. That's great. Yeah, they had those. That must have been. They must have found that before they launched Gus Grissom, I would imagine. I know they launched a couple of monkeys in the early Gemini missions. But I didn't hear that any of those blew up. But apparently, they must have did some tests and realized that. This titanium idea is not a good idea. Back to you.
No, I don't have anything more to add, so thanks very much for answering my question about the Super Dracos.
Yeah, most of the check valves I've come across are all made of brass, you know. So, you know, they don't rot. They're strong as hell. And, I don't know what they switched over to with Gemini, or for that matter, Apollo. But, very good. All right, I'm looking at the time quarter after, so we'll shut this part of the net down. We'll turn it back over to Roy. Thank all the stations that listened to this and participated. And Roy, over to you. AC2GS, this is WS2N. Let's see, tomorrow night is the Love Info Net. And that's what we said. 8:30. That's on 8. Back to you, Roy.
Thank you very much, Paul. Once again, this is AC2GS Roy here, net control operator for the Limewalk Technical Net. And as always, as we put a bow on it tonight, if you have any mailbag questions,